Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Hamburger Hill, also known as Hill 937 in Vietnam. The battle, which was fought over 10 days in 1969, was a direct assault against a heavily defended and strategically insignificant hill. More than 60 U.S. servicemen died, sparking outrage back home, especially after Americans abandoned the hill several days later, and it was once again taken over by North Vietnamese forces. Protesters and politicians in the U.S. said those killed died for no reason, and they called for an end to the war. It was a pivotal point in the war because after the battle, President Richard Nixon publicly announced the first major American troop withdrawals, beginning the nation's slow, protracted exit from Vietnam. 50 years ago this week, the battle for Hamburger Hill, our guest, Dr. Conrad Crane, the Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at the Carlisle Barracks in Carlisle. Dr. Crane, welcome back to the program.
Yep, always glad to be here. Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, 50 years, and it's not just about the combat portion of this. This was a significant event when it came to the late 60s and the Vietnam War and how it ended. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'll start with the big question, Dr. Crane. Why was Hamburger Hill such a significant battle?
Well, it's not so much what happens as when it happens. I mean, there's a lot of myths about Hamburger Hill. I mean, they're not the tank trying to take the hill. They're trying to destroy the North Vietnamese unit that's on it, which they do. There's a lot of misrepresentations about it that happened. And the problem It's significant because of when it happens. I mean, you've had in 1968, of course, you have the Tet Offensive, great disillusionment afterwards. Public support for the war starts to wane. In the beginning of 1969, the North Vietnamese also have about 40 days of a lot of attacks. And so what happens is that the American forces set out to do a bunch of spoiling attacks to try to reduce the ability of the enemy to continue their offensive. And one of the areas where there's a big buildup is in the Ash Chao Valley, which is a very tough place to get to in the northern part of South Vietnam. It's very close to the Laotian border. There's a lot of forces coming through. And what happens is the 801st Airborne goes into that region, and one of their battalions finds an enemy position on top of Hill 937. One of the things that's unusual about this battle is that the North Vietnamese actually stand and fight instead of running away. As the movie depicts and as the writings about it, it's a heavy fighting. It's a successful operation. The 101st Airborne basically destroys the 29th North Vietnamese Regiment, which is what it's designed to do. It's not out to take terrain. It's out to destroy the unit. But there's a number of things that happen, though, to make it the perception of the public much worse. One of the things is right in the middle of the battle, President Nixon makes his Vietnamization speech and says, "We're turning the war over to the Vietnamese. We're pulling back." And then the next thing they know, there's a big article in the AP by Jay Sharbutt talks about this battle in Hamburger Hill and reluctant troops being forced up the hill and heavy casualties. Senators Kennedy and Young get up in the Senate and say, "Why are we doing this? We're wasting lives." So then the front turns out that they talk about, "Oh, you abandoned the hill. Why did we attack the hill in the first place?" There's a big investigation. The Army actually has to prepare a memorandum that's sent to the president. I have all this stuff in the files, the Army Heritage Education Center, mm-hmm. Great, all that great archive.
You actually have one of the files with you, right?
I've got the memo to the president right here, and it explains what happened. And again, the point is not to take the hill. The point is to destroy the unit, which they do. About 70 Americans get killed, hundreds of wounded. Coming at the same time that Nixon just did this Vietnamization speech, it just seems contradictory. And there's a realization after Hamburger Hill, there's a realization in all levels of the American command structure up to the president that the Americans are no longer going to stand for war of attrition. We're going to have to fight this war a different way. And it reinforces the impetus to Vietnamize, to make the South Vietnamese carry most of the burden of the war for American withdrawals. Again, it in a tactical sense, it is a successful operation. The 101st Airborne Division does eventually, after 10 very tough days of combat, destroy the 29th NVA Regiment.
But, see, I can't, sorry to interrupt, but yeah. I can't help thinking about the Tet Offensive, which you mentioned, which was 1968, the year before,
right.
Which tactically was an American military victory. But back home, you started to hear from the media, you started hearing from elected officials, protests got louder that, you know, why are we fighting this war? And now here we are a year later. So
yes.
Is this just on top of Tet that Hamburger Hill becomes such a rallying point for those who are against the war?
I mean, yes, it just it exacerbates the trend that's already started, this loss of support. I mean, there are numerous battles that are bloodier than Hamburger Hill. I mean, the Aya Drang, the Dak To, Tet itself. And Aya Drang's another one where we go, you know, Hal Moore and his heroism, we were soldiers once and young. That's another battle we go in, we fight this nasty battle, and we leave. And the North Vietnamese take the battlefield again. And there's no big, there's not none of this hoopla in 1965 and over the Aya Drang. But again, it's the timing. The American people are losing they no longer, you know, they're losing support for the war. The protests have increased. Again, and the Nixon speech right in the middle of the battle that we're pulling back seems to the battle seems to contradict the sense of his speech. It's just a lot of things come together at the same time, and it does. It's like Tet. It reinforces this loss of support that Tet really starts.
Mm. It also sounds like one hand doesn't know what the other's doing. Like there's a lack of communication, at least from the administration, the Nixon administration, onto the battlefield.
Well, the speech is done. He's not involved in the day-to-day tactical operations.
Right.
And the only reason it happens is because the 101st is in the Ashau Valley just trying to make sure the enemy's not massing from Laos to come in, and it just runs into these it's not like they planned this major battle on Hill 937. It just happens, and it's, so you're right, the events are independent of each other, but they tend to make it appear like there's no coordination going on between the leadership.
This was 50 years ago this week. Is Hamburger Hill, as you said, you know, we're looking at just over 70 who were KIA and 400 casualties, American casualties. Is this one of those, and maybe there are many throughout Vietnam, that after the fact became more significant when, through the lens of history, we can look back at it and say, this was a turning point. This was a pivotal point of the war.
Well, historians always have the last word. I mean, there's all kinds of statements. You know. You know, Winston Churchill once said, you know, history will be kind to me because I aim to write it. And he does, after World War II, control it. He gets his massive, I think it's 6-volume history of World War II out very quickly after the war, and he's really shaped the way that we've looked at World War II because of that. So it's you're right. I mean, hindsight is always 20/20, and there's a lot of things that again, Tet and Hamburger Hill are both tactical victories, but strategic disasters, and the historians provide the final word, but at the same time, the impact in 1969 is significant, and you can't go back and change that. And it does exacerbate this drop in support for the war.
You mentioned that Hamburger Hill, by the way, how did it get its name? I know the answer to this question, but I think it's something that, for context, we have to point out how it got its name.
I guess you know them more than I do on that one. I know it's you know, there's again, I know there's the AP article, but I'm not, why don't you tell me, because
well,
I don't know.
Well, this story that I had heard is that there was an American serviceman who said that when they asked how bad it was by a reporter, said, do you ever see how meat is ground up like a hamburger in those old we all, our grandparents had them. Maybe some of us did, where you turn the handle and hamburger would come out. He said that's what it was like. So that's how it got its name. At least that's from what I've read.
I wouldn't be surprised, because there were reporters there. Like I said, Sherbert writes that article for the AP. And it was a nasty battle. I mean, this was unusual that the North Vietnamese had they had spider holes. They had a very intricate bunker system that actually resisted. They dropped 1 million pounds of napalm and bombs on that hill. They basically stripped the hill of vegetation at the top from all the airstrikes and artillery. The bunkers stood up to it. I mean, they're very well built. Very unusual for this kind of an intricate defensive system by the North Vietnamese inside South Vietnam.
This was a 3,000-foot hill. That's not what I think of as a hill, but it was all jungle, so that's for the reason for the napalm as well.
Oh, it was a nasty fight. It was again, the accounts of it, by the end of the battle, that it looked like old Baldy. I mean, the top of it was just completely, the vegetation was completely gone, burn off, blown off. And there were a number of friendly fire incidents, too, that contributed to the casualties, especially with air support.
Well, and then, you know, when you hear that and about the amount of napalm, the bombs, all that, and then just days later the hill is abandoned, you can understand why a lot of people looked at it and said, why'd we do this? What a waste.
Well, it's a lot of people had a hard time understanding the whole search and destroy approach, where you're just going out and the whole war of attrition. Again, the hill was not important. It was the NVA regiment on the hill, but people didn't perceive that. It was hard to explain that the leadership never really did do a good enough job on that.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I encourage you to check out some of the upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. Some of the shows that we're working on: the York County Heritage Rail Trail, preserving historical documents, and the challenges facing some Central Pennsylvania residents, according to a survey by the United Way. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Hamburger Hill in Vietnam, a pivotal battle, not just on the battlefield, but the result of it and what happened back here in at home after the battle, and how the public perceived what was going on in Vietnam. Our guest today, Dr. Conrad Crane, the Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at the Carlisle Barracks. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Heath in New Cumberland. Heath, you're on the air. Hello, Heath. Okay, I think we're having a little problem with our phone system here, so we'll try to get Heath back in just a moment here. You mentioned the location. You said strategically it was really not that important of a location, but it was very close to Laos. And, you know, I have to admit that some of the terms that we're hearing during this program bring back a lot of memories. Vietnamization. But the Ho Chi Minh Trail went through Laos and also Vietnam, supplies that came from North Vietnam to the South. And the United States at that point had not gotten, I don't believe, you tell me, but had not gone into Laos. And that's where the North Vietnamese would escape to. So that does sound like there was some strategy, that there was some importance to the location.
Well, yeah, the A Sha Valley was an important route in from Laos into South Vietnam. It was very hard to get to, very isolated. So yeah, it's an important route, and that's what they were trying to shut off. I think one thing I wanted to add to the discussion that we've had so far is this battle was not only fought in Vietnam, it was also fought on the floors of the Senate. Because I mentioned the fact that Senators Kennedy and Senator Young made major statements about the battle against it. Eventually, Senator Strom Thurmond put into the congressional record, more an official statement of what happened to Hamburger Hill to try to counteract Senators Kennedy and Young. And General Zeiss, commander of the 101st Airborne Division, was actually sent up to the Senate for confirmation for a third star after this battle, and he was confirmed. So he was promoted to lieutenant general, even with all the hoopla about Hamburger Hill. So, the battle was fought in a number of different locations, a number of different spinoffs.
Let's try Heath again. Heath, are you there? No, Heath is there, but for some reason I can't bring Heath up. This is my first day back in 2 weeks, and apparently not everything is running at 100%, everything the way it should be running. But we will get Heath on the air here in just a moment.
The Russians are jamming.
I would not doubt that. But, one of the things that you do at the U.S. Army War College and AHAC in Carlisle is that these battles, they're not just academic for you. They're studied. They're looked at to see what mistakes were made, what went well, what didn't. So when you look at Hamburger Hill, what was learned?
Well, again, it if you look at the time, Hamburger Hill reinforced the perception of the American leaders that they had the war of attrition was no longer acceptable, and that Vietnamization and withdrawal was the way to go. It just aren't going to be any more Hamburger Hills. Those operations are going to end. So it helps reinforce the changing aspect of the war. And for those of us again today, you look at it and you can see that it's a great. It reinforces the importance of information. Having done a lot of work with General Petraeus, he was very, very concerned with the way making sure that his operations were understood what was going on. And Iraq, of course, was very complicated. But it was obvious in this that effort was not made for Hamburger Hill, for what was going on in Aschau, that there wasn't any attempt to explain the nature of, and when the explanation came out, it was too late. The impression of the battle had already been formed in the public mind. One of the General Petraeus's tenets was be first with the truth, and also don't put lipstick on a pig. So even if you had something bad happened, you had to get out and get the story out first, and before somebody else spun something differently and perhaps got things wrong. So I think so there's a lot of information lessons that come out of this, the battle in the Aschau as well. But again, the big impact at the time was just to reinforce the sense that we got to change the way we're fighting the war. We just can't afford to do this kind of war of attrition anymore.
Well, Heath is no longer there, but one thing that Heath did say is that Heath, and I don't know whether Heath is male or female, says the Battle of Hamburger Hill was basically a stalemate. Just wanted to make the comment. You're raising your eyes.
Well, it was a bloody 10 days. I mean, they went up the hill a couple times, and eventually they took the hill. I mean, it was, if you want to characterize the first 8 or 9 days of the battle as a stalemate, it pretty much was. But eventually they did, of course, they brought in extra troops. Initially, we had one battalion attacking up a hill where there was at least one enemy battalion, maybe two, and they were bringing more troops in from Laos during the battle. Eventually, it takes four American battalions to take that hill, three American battalions and one South Vietnamese battalion to take that hill. So we have to bring more and more forces in to actually accomplish the mission.
So 70 American servicemen that were killed, 400 casualties, the wounded. What about the North Vietnamese?
I mean, it's one of the dilemmas here is if the official body count that was between 500 and 600, it's like 633 or something, but it's hard to tell because they're right next to the Laotian border, so a lot of casualties were being dragged off the hill back into Laos. The body counts were notoriously inaccurate anyway. We'll probably never know, but the thing that is significant is the 29th NVA regiment disappears from intelligence reports. So obviously had enough impact to basically destroy that unit.
You said that what was unusual about this battle was that the North Vietnamese didn't turn and run. again, looking back in history, that's not the picture that many Americans see. That, you know, we've heard over the years that the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, were tough fighters, and that they, you know, they didn't have traditional, up until that point, traditional battlefield tactics. And so that was one of the reasons it was such a difficult fight. But so the North Vietnamese actually would turn and run?
Well, I mean, this was a set defensive position. It was obvious they were using, they could have set up the Ash Chao as a major base to move into South Vietnam, which was foiled. But it, very rarely did they run into these kind of heavy defenses. I mean, you're talking built-in bunkers and all kinds of interconnected fields of fire. I mean, very well designed. One of the reasons that, you know, it was a great surprise the Americans run into this kind of defensive position, because the North Vietnamese, you know, there've been a number of offensive operations by the North Vietnamese at the beginning of 1969. But generally, when we try to strike them, they would disappear. They wouldn't stand and fight. And that's kind of the way most of the war was. They wouldn't stand and fight and take the casualties. That's kind of the way that their warfare was designed. You don't stand, especially when you're up against a stronger force. But in this case, it was different. And again, we were surprised by the intricacy of this defensive system, which they had not seen for quite a while from them.
Was that the first of how this defensive system was used, one of the first? I mean, did it continue throughout the war, or did it go back to where, okay, put up a fight and then, I don't want to say run and hide, but take some other defensive positions?
Yeah, they generally, after this, they didn't. The North Vietnamese may have learned some stuff from this battle as well, because they didn't stand that you don't see more of these fights. But again, we're not looking for them, and they're not offering them. I mean, they then tend to, especially once we announce we're going to withdraw, that lessens the whole impetus to attack. The North Vietnamese adopt kind of a waiting strategy, and of course, until the 72, where that's the Easter offensive, where they'll come out and do a major offensive, and then of course 75 when they actually can't conquer South Vietnam. But yeah, this is a rarity that the war turns much more into the hit and run and evading contact after this.
We have Barry from Dillsburg on the phone, and I understand, Barry, you were there, correct?
I was in the 1st Aviation Brigade, and we provided pathfinders as four elements for operations for all units that were going into areas. So we had been pulled up to Camp Eagle with Honor First probably about a month before, maybe 6 weeks before Dong Ap Bai, which in Vietnamese is the Mountain of the Crouching Beast. And so we didn't know what the operation would be. Once we got there, we realized we were now attached to 101st, which was not unusual. We did a lot of work for the CAV and the Marines in the 1st Artillery Division. But early on, I think what we were told is that the Kit Carson scouts realized that the Vietnamese who were there were part of the 29th NVA Regiment. That was Ho Chi Minh's favorite regiment. And I can believe that General Vase, whose call sign was Wild Turkey, couldn't resist if that unit was going to stand and to take them on. And I'm sure that's what happened. I rotated immediately before the battle back to a 30-day leave and then back for my second tour. So my team stayed there. And the word that we had was that there were Korean veterans who were also serving in Vietnam at the time. And they referred to Korea having Pork Chop Hill and said they referred to it then as Hamburger Hill, said, well, Vietnam has to have its own name. But it was absolutely a meat grinder. Our medic who was with us served, and he and I served after that fact. It was really a brutal battle.
So, Barry, did you know what was going on back home after Hamburger Hill?
Yeah, it was interesting because during the election, my first team that was on was in Way City, and that was a complete nightmare. And the election was coming up. On leave before I went over, Martin Luther King had been assassinated, and then when we were in Way, I still was communicating a little bit with my family and talked about being sharp in terms of what you're hearing about the war. And our hopes at that time was Bobby Kennedy would evolve. And, of course, when we got the news that he was killed, it was a downer. And so we kind of heard what was happening, but the news we got with two sources was U.S. Army Stars and Stripes and AFVN Radio, Armed Forces Vietnam Network, and Hanoi Hannah. And interestingly, we listened to both. Both of them propagandized us. We felt better about Hanoi Hannah propagandizing because we knew that was openly propaganda. We did have a feel for what was happening, but we weren't really cognizant because we didn't have time to be. It was just day to day and sometimes minute to minute dealing with the reality in front of us. And so we didn't do a lot of intellectualizing at that time.
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much, and thank you for your service as well. Interesting that he said that those that were right there at Hamburger Hill were supporting Senator Robert Kennedy running for president, who had vowed to end the war.
Of course, by now he's dead. So it's talking on 68's
right,
a tumult.
Right, right. He was talking about Tet when he talked about right, in 1968 right, with his Way City. But we're almost out of time, Dr. Crane. This is really interesting 50 years later. It's hard to believe it's in that much time. What's the legacy of Hamburger Hill?
Well, no, we've been talking about it all. It's this image of the image that's come out of it is an image of futility. It in many ways it's become a symbol for the American campaign in Vietnam with this seemingly meaningless casualty list. It's the end of the war of attrition. I mean, if you want to pick a point when the war changes, the war is going to change after Hamburger Hill, and for the Americans it becomes a very different war.
Dr. Conrad Crane is the Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at Carlisle Barracks. Dr. Crane, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I always enjoy it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF. Your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, actually, we're going to be on a Smart Talk road trip. Coming up on tomorrow's show, where the York County Heritage Rail Trail near Hanover Junction in York County. And I'm going to be out there talking about the rail trail, talking about hiking. And we invite you, there's still time, if you would like to come along, watch the show being produced, and take a little hike afterwards. You can go to WYTF.org and /SmartTalk and get all the information right there. Pennsylvania will hold a special election on May 21st for the 12th district position held by U.S. Congressional Representative Tom Marino. He announced in January his decision to leave following his reelection to a two-year term last November. Joining us on Smart Talk to discuss his campaign is Mark Friedenberg. Mark Friedenberg is the Democrat who is running for Congress in the 12th Congressional District. The 12th Congressional District is located in central and northern Pennsylvania. It includes Perry, Juniata, Mifflin, Snyder, and Union counties, and parts of Northumberland and Montour counties in the WITF listening area. And Mark Friedenberg, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
I should say welcome back to the program, because it was just last year that we spoke when you were running against Congressman Marino. So I guess I should ask the big question first, and then we'll go into some of the issues and, what's transpired over the last few months. But why are you running again?
You know, it's the same reasons that I ran last year. We are going backwards in so many key areas in America. You know, the main reason that I decided to run was after the attempted repeal of the Affordable Care Act back in 2017. And I was worried about, what that would do, because we had no alternative in mind from congressional Republicans, no protections for people with pre-existing conditions. And we, I think, needed people, ordinary people, who were willing to stand up and hopefully, show a model for what good civic involvement could look like. And here we are today, the front page of USA Today says that we had 1.1 million more people without health insurance in last year than we did the year before. So we continue to go backwards. We're still held up by all the same problems that we were in November of 2018. I think it's still a time for ordinary people to step up and make sure we can leave behind a better world for our kids and grandkids.
Well, since you brought up health care right off the bat, let me get right into that. You support single-payer Medicare for All insurance program. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is an option for people to buy into the Medicare program. Medicare is extremely well-run. It's incredibly cost-effective. But it's limited in terms of who can get access to it. And I think it makes a lot of sense to give people who either have insurance through their employer now or don't have insurance now the option to buy into that program, because the market, the for-profit private insurance market, has failed us in so many ways. You know, last year, Americans borrowed $88 billion for healthcare costs. It's the number one cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States. And again, we still have 30 million Americans who are without health care. If you believe, like I do, that health care is a fundamental right for every American, then we have to take action. And we have a good model in the Medicare system, which has some consolidated bargaining power. I'd like to see it be expanded so that Medicare can negotiate for prescription drug prices. It's frankly absurd that that hasn't happened yet, because there seems to be such broad bipartisan support for it. But I think that's a common sense way forward. But an even more important part, I think, is this idea of decoupling. Right now, for many Americans, their health care status is coupled with their employment status. And that means that people are afraid to leave their job because they have health care benefits, and they're worried that if they wanted to, say, start up their own small businesses, they would go without health care. And it makes it harder for small businesses to compete with larger ones that are able to offer more attractive benefits packages, including healthcare. So in a district like ours that doesn't have a lot of these big businesses, that has so many people who are without healthcare, I think it makes a lot of sense to move at least to an option where people can decouple and they can get insurance through the Medicare program. And this is, of course, without eliminating private insurance. There are many people who get Medicare and also private supplemental insurance, and I think that's still an option. We want people to have that choice. But for people without health care now, they have no choice at all. They're dying. They're going without the care that they need. The for-profit insurance industry has really failed us.
You know, the question that always arises from Medicare for All is how to pay for it. I mean, there have been a lot of figures put out there, including one, $30 trillion of what it would cost. I mean, it obviously would cost American taxpayers more money. But how do you answer that question of what this would cost?
Yeah, and I'm not sure, frankly, that it would cost American taxpayers more money. You know, you look at how are we paying for health care now. Well, right off the bat, there are 30 million people who are going without health care. And again, there was that $88 billion that we borrowed just last year. But the idea is that by going to this single-payer Medicare-type program, having that consolidated bargaining power, that we would be able to eliminate that 20% or so of profit that's pretty much baked into the Affordable Care Act, as well as the overhead for basically denying people's claims that the for-profit insurance companies do. Overall, it would help us to lower costs. You know, we have by far the highest per-patient cost in the United States and anywhere else in the world. And unfortunately, we're not leading the world in the best healthcare outcomes either. We're spending the most, but we don't get the best outcomes. I think the question is, you know, what are the goals? I think the goal is making sure that every American has access to quality, affordable care, and then what's the best way forward? And I think Medicare is a proven way forward.
And I should rephrase that question by when I said that it obviously would cost American taxpayers more money. I think up front is probably how I should have put that in context. What you're saying is that in the long run, that there may be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, won't some type of tax have to go up, but in the long run, you're saying American taxpayers would save money?
Yeah, I think it's a shift in how you're paying. I mean, right now, for many Americans, you know, their employer is paying, and then they're paying also the employee. You know, that's what I do for my employer, for my family's health care. It's a difference in where you're paying it to. I would rather pay it into a program that's very efficiently run, rather than a for-profit insurance company that may not have my best interests at heart.
You talking about your district, it's a large district, and it's mostly rural. Yes, there are some cities and larger boroughs in the 12th district. State College is what the one that comes to mind right off the bat, where there's Penn State. There's you know, some others like Lewisburg. Not huge, but still, you know, some good-sized places. But it's mostly a rural district with so many counties. Opioids, the opioid crisis has been a huge problem, especially in rural areas of Pennsylvania. You have vowed to provide more money from the federal government, if elected, to fighting the opioid crisis. In what way?
Yeah, and you know, I should say that earlier this year, you know, Congress did pass additional funding for it, and I think that's great. For the opioid crisis, I think there's really three things that we need to do. First, we need to eliminate the stigma associated with addiction, and certainly including opioid addiction. There are a lot of people that, because they think it's a moral failure, they don't seek treatment for themselves, or they don't seek treatment for family members or loved ones, and that unfortunately can lead to loss of life. We need to make sure that people have access to the kinds of treatment options that they need. And for a lot of people, according to the experts that I talk to, that may require, you know, many months of inpatient treatment and rehabilitation, and then maybe a lifetime of medication-assisted treatment to help with that addiction and hold it down. And then looking forward, you know, we need to definitely invest in the kinds of, you know, basic research for pain management, for chronic pain. You know, medical marijuana is something that people are talking a lot about. I think it certainly seems to hold some promise as, you know, for pain relief. It also seems to hold some promise for treating the underlying addiction itself. So we need to make sure that we're investing in that kind of research. And we also need to make sure that we're holding the companies that created this really uniquely American tragedy in the first place. And I'm glad to see that some executives of pharmaceutical manufacturing and distribution companies are now actually facing criminal indictment. Pennsylvania's Attorney General and others are bringing cases against these pharmaceutical companies for lying to doctors and lying to patients, knowing about the habit-forming properties of these drugs. You know, this is the kind of accountability that we didn't see after the financial crisis. We didn't arrest Wall Street executives, and I think that makes it more likely that something similar is going to happen again. I'm really glad to see for the opioid crisis, we're starting to see some accountability both through criminal cases and then also through civil cases.
When you talk about removing that stigma from addiction, is that the role of Congress? I mean, are you advocating that Congress would have some type of role there?
You know, I'm not sure that it's about passing a particular law necessarily, but I think being in Congress, there's a lot of roles involved. It's not just, you know, passing legislation. Parts of it involves, you know, showing some leadership. I know you're there to be a representative, but you've got a platform, and you need to use it, and you need to put a spotlight on the tragedies, the sorrows that people are suffering, the good things too, but the tragedies to show, you know, this is a real person, let's say, who is addicted to opioids. This is not a bad person. This is somebody who, for example, had hurt their back, was prescribed OxyContin, and then became addicted. I mean, you have a platform, and you should use it, I think, if you're in Congress, to put a spotlight on the things that need to be focused on.
So the second part of that, when you say that you think the federal government should be providing more funding, where's that money come from? Are you, you always have to talk about when you're discussing increasing funding for these programs, where the money derives from.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, in this case in particular, I think, you know, additional funding for NIH for grants for research into chronic pain management and into addiction treatment make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
You have Penn State, Lock Haven, Penn Tech in Williamsport, Bucknell, all universities in your district. I've seen that you've said that we have to find a way to find higher education, help it to grow. A lot of times with many candidates over the last year or so, when we've heard about, for example, Medicare for All, the next thing is that free college tuition. Where do you stand on an issue like that?
Yeah, and you know, I don't support free college tuition. You know, I'm on the faculty at Penn State. I'm a strong supporter of college. It's not the right choice for everybody, though. And I think that we don't want to have people starting down the path of a four-year degree when it may not be the right choice for them. Maybe some other kind of career and technical education, apprenticeship, or whatever the case might be. So it's not the right choice for everybody. And I'd like to see people have some skin in the game when they make a decision to go to college. And I think the federal government does need to play a role in making it possible for the people who have decided it's the right choice for them to actually do it. So I support on a needs-based basis the federal government covering up to half the cost of tuition, and especially making sure that we increase the government loans that are available, keep those interest rates down, go after those predatory for-profit colleges of the kind that Betsy DeVos is such a fan of. They're the ones that are really contributing to that $1.5 trillion in combined student loan debt that Americans are carrying that is holding down our economy in so many ways, from people not buying cars, not getting married, not buying a house. The ripple effects are almost unimaginable.
The third prong, when you hear about Medicare for All and then free college tuition, as you said, you don't support that, is an increase in the minimum wage. And you support that, don't you?
I do. I'm glad that Governor Wolf here in the Commonwealth and Senator Casey and many others across the country are supporting the fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage. If you agree with me that, if you put in a fair day's work, you should get a fair day's pay, we need to look at the federal minimum wage and say, hey, why has that not kept up with inflation? Why has that not kept up with the cost of living? The federal minimum wage, which is the Pennsylvania minimum wage also of $7.25 an hour, nowhere in this district, even in this rural district that you talk about, would 40 hours a week at $7.25 an hour be able to, afford your rent and groceries. It is far too low. And what it's leading to is corporate welfare that, employees who are working for minimum wage are understandably taking advantage of other governmental benefits programs to make up the difference. I think that it ought to be on the employers to make sure that they're paying their employees fairly. And the fight for $15 hour minimum wage simply reflects that. Everybody, almost everybody agrees that we ought to have a minimum wage. Then it becomes a line drawing exercise. And I think that if you look at over the decades where the federal minimum wage has been and what the cost of living has been, you'll see that we're far too low.
So you don't put any stock in those who say that raising the minimum wage would cost jobs, including Pennsylvania's independent fiscal office that said that under the governor's plan, there would be more than 30,000 jobs lost?
Well, you have to kind of look at the big picture here, which is what's going to happen when we put that much more money back into workers' pockets? They're going to spend it. You contrast it with, again, coincidentally, $1.5 trillion that we added to the deficit late in 2017 with the GOP's tax bill. The 83% of the benefits of that went to the wealthiest Americans and to corporations. And for the most part, they sat on that money. It was stock buybacks. It was dividends. It didn't really help to grow the economy. But we have decades of experience showing us now that when you put money into everyday working Americans' pockets, they spend it. It stimulates the economy. They make that car payment. They get the health care services that they need. I think that's really important.
If you're just tuning in, yes, there is a special election coming up in the 12th Congressional District on May 21st. It's primary election day for all of Pennsylvanians, or at least those registered as Democrats and Republicans. But it's primary election day, also special election day in the 12th District. Our guest is the Democratic candidate for Congress, the House of Representatives in the 12th. 12th District. Mark Friedenberg, the 12th Congressional District is located in central and northern Pennsylvania and includes Perry, Juliana, Mifflin, Snyder, and Union counties, and parts of Northumberland and Montour counties in the WITF listening area. And by the way, we will have Mr. Friedenberg's Republican opponent, Fred Keller, coming up on the program a little bit later this week, so you will get to hear both candidates and where they do stand on the issues. Mr. Friedenberg, from looking at your website and where you stand on issues, you're also very strong pro-union. What does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it means that, you know, our unions were really the creators of this strong middle class in America, and they're under attack right now on a lot of different fronts from a lot of different groups. There are groups that want to pass these so-called right-to-work laws that are really designed to gut unions, especially in Pennsylvania, making sure that, or what they're trying to do, is to make it so that union members basically don't have to pay dues, and that's going to eliminate the unions as we know it. But I think unions more generally stand up for working Americans, stand up for a fair day's pay, stand up for protections for workers, you know, safety protections, environmental protections, making sure that we have fair trade policies for the United States so that American workers aren't held to different standards than workers in the rest of the world. You know, we've got a lot of steel workers. We've got a lot of plumbers and pipe fitters. We have, I'm very, very proud to have the endorsement of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. But these are workers who fighting for their basic rights, and I'm really, really proud to stand with them.
Mm-hmm. And we only have a few minutes left. There's so many follow-up questions I'd like to ask and other issues. I'll try to get to as much as I can. We really haven't talked about and haven't mentioned the president's name at this point. There are a number of candidates, Democrats, who ran last year and I'm sure will be running next year and will be calling for impeachment of the president, or at least that the president be held accountable for many of the things. There's like 20 investigations going on right now. I'll just ask the broad question. Where do you stand on President Trump?
You know, I think there are a lot of areas where we ought to be able to work with President Trump, you know, making sure that we can get Medicare to negotiate the drug prices with pharmaceutical companies is one. You know, he campaigned on better, cheaper health care for everybody, as we've discussed. I think there's a good way forward on that. But then that infrastructure spending, there was a meeting in the Oval Office, I guess, about 2 weeks ago now. Looks like there's some promise on actually investing maybe a significant and needed amount of money in critical infrastructure in the United States, roads and bridges. Here in the district in Williamsport, the largest city, we've got a levee situation that the levee needs to be recertified, or we're going to have catastrophic flood insurance increases that might drive out businesses. So there are plenty of areas, I think, where we can find common ground and actually get things done, because that's what people want. You know, I've been knocking on a lot of doors lately, canvassing, and a couple of things I hear are, first, people don't know that independent and unaffiliated voters can vote in the special election. So, yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And they're just sick of, why can't these guys get anything done? I think there are a couple of areas where there are critical needs that can be met, I think, in this Congress.
Would you support impeachment?
I don't know what the basis for it would be, but I'm really interested in making sure that we take that part of the Mueller report that was about Russia's attempts to meddle in our election and take the hint. They are going to continue doing it. The director of the FBI, Director Wray, has said that for Russia, and it's not just Russia, but for Russia, interfering in America is now 365-day-a-year operation. We need to be investing in critical infrastructure, including cybersecurity, and making sure that we are doing everything that we can to protect our electoral system and make sure that every American's vote is counted.
Mark Friedenberg, we only have a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. In that minute, if you would, leave a message for voters on why you think you're the better candidate for this job.
Oh, thanks so much, Scott. You know, I'll actually just talk about an issue that we haven't discussed yet this morning, which is climate change and man-made climate change. And like I said, my view is we have to leave behind a better world for our kids. I've got daughters, Claire and Molly. They're 5 and 3. And we have a report from the UN and thousands of others that tell us We have about a dozen years to take meaningful action to combat the effects of man-made climate change, or we're going to face runaway effects that are going to be irreversible. I think a clear way forward is moving to a renewable energy-based economy in Pennsylvania. We're in a great position to do it. We've been leaders in coal and oil and natural gas, and we're in a great position to be leaders in renewables because of our universities, because of our manufacturing, because of our skilled workforce. But it's going to take somebody who understands the scope of the problem, who isn't bought off by fossil fuel and other corporate interests, and is really willing to look up, take a tab of the sand, and see what are the problems we face and how can we take advantage of the opportunities created by solving them. And I look forward to doing that in Congress.
Mark Friedenberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we are at the York County Rail Trail in Hanover Junction, so be sure to tune in.